All right, once again, brethren, good morning. It is a pleasure to be here with you. It's a real privilege to serve at this convention. And Sister Tricia and I bring the love and greetings of our ecclesia at home. And again, I can't tell you how blessed I feel to be here among you. You know, based on our discussions of yesterday, as I was doing my own personal preparation for those discussions and looking to try to say, okay, well, how do you sort of end a convention that has such a very focused theme? I prayed about it and I felt very compelled to give some thoughts that, in my mind, would help us to stay with that internal focus on becoming more sanctified in our own thinking. Because as we were talking about this yesterday, all you have control over, brethren, is what goes on between your two ears and then what transfers into your own heart. That's all you can control. And in all of the difficulties that we face and all of the trials and the frustrations that we potentially have with one another, we must always come back to, what about me? Am I contributing to the healing work, or am I contributing to the divisiveness? Those are some of the things we want to address this morning. And the question, what if you're wrong, is a hard question to ask. Have you ever thought about that? When we get into the situations where we begin to knock heads with our brother or our sister, one of the instincts, one of the human instincts of that circumstance is to defend yourself more fully rather than listen. And I don't know if you've ever had this happen. And a lot of what I'm going to say to you today, I speak to you from personal experience. Rather than listening, you're thinking about what I'm going to tell them next. And I'll get them with this. And they're not thinking about that, so I will make sure they understand it. And what we do is we put ourselves in a posture that ends up not listening and not healing, but further dividing. But in all of that, the question is, well, what if you're wrong? What if whatever it is you are standing for, what if your understanding is not complete? What if, in fact, the brother or sister on the other side of the issue has a better understanding? How do you find that out? What do you do to disarm yourself so that you can see more clearly? That's what this is about this morning. We all have to judge. And we're going to talk about some examples of proper judgment. There's judgment of others. There is some necessary judgment of others. There's judgment of ourselves. There's judgment of situations. There's judgment of right. There's judgment of wrong. All of these are necessary parts of our Christian walk. But the question is, how can you tell if your judgment in this situation or that may be right or wrong? Is it always most important to be right? Are there situations where even though we may be wrong, we might be considered right? Is attitude more important than being right? How do we handle judgment from others? Whose standards do you use? And again, what if you're wrong? I don't know that we're going to be able to answer all of those questions, but at least we're going to put them on the table as a basis for our discussion. Our theme text is Romans chapter 14, verse 10. And before I read that, let me just mention, and you know, the program says that discourse with questions, and similar to the way Brother David formatted his presentation this morning, I'd like to do the same thing. I am very comfortable with the interchange of brethren asking a question or seeking a clarification, or so please, if while I'm discussing something with you, you would like to discuss it back with me or ask a question or seek a clarification, just make sure that I see you. Okay, I have no, that is a very comfortable situation. Romans 14:10. Why do you pass judgment on your brother or sister? Or you, why do you Why do you despise your brother or sister? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. We're going to look at Romans 14 as a basis for a lot of our discussion here this morning. Before we get started, though, I want to explain a few things. I want to tell you what I'm not trying to do here. Okay, the first thing I'm not trying to do is look to change anybody's mind on anything. All right? We're not looking to ruffle anybody's feathers, and we are not going to deal directly with any issues of controversy, moral or doctrinal. What we are going to do is going to deal with some of the thinking behind the issues. We are going to look to deepen and purify our own convictions. And then we are looking to challenge, and this is important, we are looking to challenge our emotions. Because, brethren, I truly believe that emotions can make us or break us. There are several words for judgment in the New Testament. Some are to scrutinize, to investigate, to separate thoroughly, or to distinguish or decide. The distinguish or deciding is what we're really going to end up having to deal with more often. That's the word krino. We're all familiar with that. As an example is Acts 17:31, because he has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness. So that's the kind of judgment that we're going to need to begin to kind of look at as we approach this question of what if you're wrong. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through these next scriptures, but I'm going to give you some references. Some examples of proper judgments of those within the fellowship. There are examples where judgment is necessary and appropriate. 1 Corinthians 2:15 talks about he that is spiritual judges all things. 1 Corinthians 5:7 through 11, situation that we had alluded to yesterday in the second study, talking about bringing that brother or putting that brother out who was acting so incredibly immorally. Galatians 6:1 through 2. There is a purpose of judgment to restore one spiritually. My friends, if anyone is detected in a transgression, you have received the Spirit, should restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. A judgment is required to be able to restore someone. Another purpose of judgment is to maintain a spiritually minded leadership amongst us. We look at the qualifications for elders in the ecclesia, and what do we see? A list. And that list says, judge accordingly to see if that brother matches that list well enough in your judgments to be able to raise your hand. We take that from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 2 through 7. And then another purpose of judgment is to maintain a self-contained order within the church. And that's 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 2. When any of you have a grievance against another, do you dare take it to the court before the unrighteous instead of taking it before saints? So there are several places and ways that we must make judgments. But again, I stress to you the question, what if we're wrong? How do we determine what to do? If we turn to Romans chapter 14, verses 1 through 13. I'm not going to read the whole thing, again, in the interest of time. But this is dealing with one of the great issues of the time in the early church, and that was the differences of the brethren of eating meat offered according to idols or not. And to us, that might sound trivial. Get over it. But to them, they were, and this had to do with the Judaizing Christianity. It had to do with the law. It had to do with the source. It had to do with circumcision. All of these things were all wrapped up. It had to do with thousands of years of God said do it this way, and all of a sudden you're saying not to? It was a major, major issue. We'll just start a little bit of reading with verse 6 in Romans 14. Those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. Also those who eat in honor of the Lord, since they gave thanks to God, while those who abstain, abstain in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God. We do not live to ourselves, we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. And if you jump down to the last part of verse 10, for we all stand before the judgment seat of God. So it's giving you two different sides of an issue, and saying, hey, we're all standing before the judgment seat of Brother Rick. No. We're all standing before the judgment seat of God. Now notice, the Apostle Paul is talking about two different sides of an issue, and in his discussion, he says that some of these are weak. So he's telling you who doesn't get it. But he doesn't distinguish their faithfulness and say, well, they're weak, so, you know, they're really not being as faithful as they ought to be. They ought to just get a little bit stronger. He doesn't minimize them because they're weak. He just distinguishes them. So he tells us who's right and who's wrong. But he doesn't take a side. Now let's think about that. Why would he not take a side? Is he saying that it doesn't matter? No. The apostle is doing two things here to establish a context with which to successfully deal with differences. First thing, the first point, is Paul taught and spoke the truth. In Romans 14:2, he said, some believe in eating anything, while the weak only eats vegetables. So he's saying, Paul here is saying, he's clearly stating the truth. He's telling you who's got it correct and who doesn't. The second thing he did, though, is the Apostle Paul honored the conviction of those with weak conscience. In Romans chapter 14, verses 6 through 8, those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. Also those who eat, eat in honor of the Lord, since they gave thanks to God. While those who abstain, abstain in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God. We do not live to ourselves. We do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. Paul, the apostle, recognized that the Lord can compensate for our shortcomings. And brethren, hear those words. The Lord can compensate for our shortcomings, and that compensation is based on our personal conviction. So what we're saying here, we're going to give you a phrase that we're going to continually come back to through this discussion. As we continue to develop the question of what if you're wrong, here is what I think the Apostle Paul is teaching us. He's teaching us in matters of difficulty to speak the truth, but honor the conviction of those you may disagree with. Speak truth, honor conviction. That's what Romans 14 is all about. So how do we tell if we're right or wrong in our conclusions and our attitudes? Well, sometimes with conclusions, it's a wait and see. Many of our conclusions, we will not know if we're right or wrong until the other side of the veil. Attitudes are a different story. Attitudes can change easily. Attitudes can be checked and rechecked. And attitudes can be reformed if they need to be. So how do you do that? Because in dealing with right and wrong, it's the attitude that comes first, and it's our attitude that will dictate where we end up going in our clash or our fellowship, we choose, with our brethren. I want to tell you very quickly of a personal experience that actually inspired this discourse. 10 years ago or so, one of my daughters, I think it was my oldest daughter, Emily, she was in her middle teenage years, and you know those are somewhat tumultuous years. She'd come home one day incredibly upset, and to this day I cannot remember what exactly happened, but she was upset about something with friends or at school, and she was just spilling it over to me. And Emily is a very passionate individual, kind of like me. And I was listening to the frustration and the anger and she just didn't get it. And literally, as I'm listening, I sat there because I know that she wanted to resolve an issue, but she was stuck. And so literally, I sat there and I took notes as I listened to her. And I wasn't watching what I was writing, so my notes are very hard to read later because I didn't want to take my eyes off of her. And I'm just writing down some key words as I'm listening to her just spill her heart out in this anguish of whatever. And again, I don't even remember what it was about. Afterwards, we talked for a long time and began to put things in perspective. And I took the words, the single words that I just wrote down from this frustration from my daughter, and that's what, and they became this discourse. So I want to share with you what I observed to be what we call seven gates of process. Seven gates of process in order to determine, to be able to see more clearly if, in fact, we are wrong. And that will be the body of what we're going to discuss this morning. Each of these gates has two entrances. You choose which entrance you're going to go in through. The entrance that you choose will dictate whether you end up in a state of fellowship or a state of clashing. I'm going to read off the seven gates with the two entrances, and then we're going to go through them one at a time. The first gate is the gate of passion versus principle. And don't worry, if you don't get it all now, I'm going to come back to each one. The second gate is the gate of comfort versus conscience. The third is convenience versus conviction. The fourth is coddling, you know, like taking care of, versus caring. The fifth is cloudy vision versus clarity of vision. Six is divisive action versus decisive action. And the seventh is hearsay as a source versus honorable sources. These are seven things that we go through mentally, and we, brethren, can choose which side of the gate we go through. And one side of the gate is going to lead us down one path, and the other side of the gate is going to lead us down another path. And the point is, brethren, we can choose. First gate, passion versus principle. This is the battle between the emotion that we feel on an issue and the principle behind the issue. And make no mistake, more often than not, it is a battle of opposing sides. Many times, the passion that we feel for an issue is not the principle of the issue. We need to determine that before we move forward. Most times, you know, and I know, it's easier to follow the emotion because that's what feels right. Oftentimes, we can mistake our passion for principle, and that can be very difficult. Remember, what we want to do in terms of dealing with being right and wrong is to be able to always speak truth and honor conviction. Our passions. James chapter 3, verses 2 through 12. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. Well, let's stop right there for a second. Because James is saying, if anyone's never at fault for what he says, then he's a perfect man, and you know and I know that that can't be true. So in fact, then, we are wrong sometimes. That's what James is telling us. You are wrong sometimes. He's letting us know that as he begins this part of his teaching. We put bits in the mouths of horses to make them obey us, and we can turn the whole animal. Or take a ship for an example. Although they are so large, they're driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes for great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue is also a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, it sets the whole course of his life on fire, and itself is set on by the fire of Gehenna. Brethren, think about the illustration that James is using here. The fire of Gehenna. What does Gehenna represent? Utter destruction, second death. That's its representation. So we're dealing with something very serious here. Verse 7, all kinds of animals, birds and reptiles and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. Interesting thing about that, we all have one, and we all know how to use it. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth comes praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. James is saying, be sure you understand that your passions expressed can bring destruction. Passion versus principle. Our passions expressed can bring destruction. Principle, if we look at Galatians 5, 14 through 18, and again, we won't read the whole thing. Just verse 16 we'll touch on here. Live by the Spirit, I say, and do not gratify the desires of the flesh. You see, now principle can be brought into focus because you live by the Spirit. And if you are living by the Spirit, there's a default, because you know what? Both of those gates don't work at the same time. If you choose the gate of passion, you're omitting the entrance through the gate of principle, which is guided by the Spirit. So if we choose passion, we're missing the Spirit. If we choose the Spirit, now, brethren, you see, if you choose the Spirit, and that's what guides you, passion is appropriate. But generally, for most of us, it's going to be toned way down. It just is for most of us. Once truly motivated by principle, then we can live out our principles with passion. In John 15, 12 to 14 is a guidance for that passion. John 15, 12 to 14, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends, and you are my friends if you do what I command you. So Jesus gave us a sense of what is to guide our passion. It is to be guided by that love one for another. And we spoke about this at length yesterday. And Luke 22, 14 to 15. When the hour came, he took his place at the table and the apostles with him. And he said, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. When it says, I have eagerly desired, that word some places is translated lust. Jesus' passions were focused on the dictates of the Spirit. And so his deepest, heartfelt needs were through the Spirit. And brethren, that's what we must strive for as we look to try and figure out how do we become healers rather than those who hurt. Passion versus principle. Please understand that as we deal with passion versus principle, we're not suggesting to you that you cannot be passionate about things, because obviously I'm a living example that's not true. All right, I don't believe in those words. What I do believe in from the depths of my heart is that our passion must pass through the gate of principle in order to express itself appropriately. Unless passion passes through the gate of principle, it is a loose cannon. So the first step in figuring out if you may in fact be wrong is to look at what is this? Remember what this is a signal of? The mirror test? Okay? Look in the mirror and see if your passion is running ahead of principle. And if it is, that first gate, that's the first place you can stop, that we can readjust, and then we can again move forward. The second gate, and remember, each gate has two entrances. When you pick one, you don't get the other. The second gate is comfort versus conscience. And I might add godly conscience to that second half of the second gate. Are we looking for a comfortable answer, or are we in tune with our inner compass? And we'll get to that inner compass in a moment. Here's an example of living according to comfort. Therefore, you have no excuse. This is Romans chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Therefore, you have no excuse, whoever you are, when you judge others. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, are doing the very same things. Follows Romans chapter 1, and we alluded to Romans chapter 1 yesterday several times in the first study. Brethren, it's often said that the faults that we see, oh, look at that. I didn't even know he was putting it up there. Yes, I'm doing an illustrated discourse. I don't know how to do an illustrated discourse, okay, just so you know. So thank you, brother. Yes? I'm sorry, that was Romans 2, verses 1 through 3. It has been said that when we see faults in another, those are the faults that are most glaring in ourselves. We don't see it in ourselves, but we can see it in another. It is comfortable to look out upon others and sort of see some of the things that may not be that great. And it's comfortable to say, to sit in the seat of judgment. And what Romans chapter 2 is saying, be careful. Because those things that you're making judgments on are those very things that you're doing. When we live through the pursuit of comfort and face the fact, brethren, we all want to be comfortable. Now, is there something inherently wrong with comfort? No. But comfort, if you are a consecrated, prospective member of the body of Christ, comfort comes in its appropriate place. It comes once our conscience, our godly conscience, has been put in gear. Then we learn to be comfortable because we have a godly conscience showing us the way. If we seek our comfort first and the godly conscience second, we're off. Remember, in dealing with others, you must always speak the truth, but honor conviction. What's your conscience tuned to? 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 2. Now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, some will renounce faith by paying attention to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the hypocrisy of liars whose consciences are seared with a hot iron. You know what happens if you sear something with a hot iron? If you put it on your skin, you're going to kill the nerves. And if you kill the nerves, can you feel anything? And if you don't feel anything, you are therefore unprotected. Understand, those nerves are there to protect you. You know, there are some rare diseases where people don't feel pain. And you think, wow, that wouldn't be a bad thing to not feel pain. Those people are in great jeopardy because they don't have feeling for pain, and so their body is not protected from their environment. That's what our conscience does to our spirit man. It protects us from harm. And if we sear that conscience with a hot iron, we're not giving it a chance to do its work. 1 Peter 2, 19 through 21. And again, I'm just going to read one part in the interest of time. Yeah, in the interest of time. But if you shall endure, when you do what's right and suffer for it, you have God's approval. Now let's think about that for a minute. If you shall endure and do what's right and suffer for it. Does that sound like comfort? It's not. You have to endure and do what's right and suffer for it. That gives you God's approval. Well, now if you know that you have God's approval, is that comforting? Absolutely. Godly conscience first produces comfort second. Human conscience first avoids the godly conscience. You enter the wrong side of this gate of process as we're determining whether we are right or wrong in our approach to a matter, and it takes us off track. It puts us in a place where we're not able to grab hold of that godly conscience nearly as well as we could have beforehand. So these gates, again, are in terms of our looking at our own stand, putting them in front of the mirror test, and look. Based on this convention, based on the studies, based on what the Ecclesia asked us to discuss yesterday, it is plain that there are so many of us that are hurting deeply. Our intention here this morning is to approach that deep hurt with hopefully spiritual guidance to say, let's see if maybe each of us, and don't for a moment think, well, you know, you're right, Brother Rick, and if only Brother So-and-so would be listening and taking notes on what you're saying, things would be better. This is not about Brother So-and-so. This is about you. If we can walk ourselves through these gates carefully, one at a time, brethren, I think you will be amazed how much more sanctified we can come out the other end of this process. We had mentioned that living according to conscience produces comfort. Oftentimes that comfort doesn't come right away. Philippians 4, 4 through 7. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again I say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to everyone. You see, a godly conscience generally produces gentleness. Now, occasionally a godly conscience, there's a righteous indignation. But you know what? That's few and far between. Okay? So godly conscience for most of us, most of the time, it produces gentleness. The Lord is near. Do not worry about anything, but at everything, by prayer and supplication, and with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And here comes the comfort. It said, "In everything, rejoice in the Lord always, no matter what the circumstance." And now in verse 7 it says, "In the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." Again, if we're entering through the godly conscience side of the gate, the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding. You know what that means when something surpasses all understanding? It means you can't even explain it. That's how powerful it is. It is beyond words. That's what a godly conscience, that's the comfort a godly conscience will produce. Number 3, convenience versus conviction. Convenience versus conviction. Do we look for an easy way out, or are we driven by a deeply convicted belief? Now here we have to begin to be very careful, because we can say that, well, no, I'm acting based on conviction. I know I'm acting based on conviction. I feel the conviction. And what happens is you go back to that first gate, and it's our passion that we're interpreting as conviction. So we have to be very careful. That's why we're breaking this up into little pieces, so that we can assess ourselves as clearly as we possibly can. Speak truth. You are required to speak the truth when dealing with these difficulties that we face one with another. But we must honor the conviction of another. These gates help us to learn how to honor the conviction of others. That's what they help us to do. They help us to be able to back away and to give true honor and respect, and so that we can see them through sanctified eyes and not human eyes. Convenience, Ephesians 4, 14 through 15. We must no longer be children tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way in Him who is the head, into Christ. And you think, well, you know, being tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine, that can't be too convenient. But it is, because you don't have to move. You just kind of go with the flow. Wherever the flow goes, you go. And if you look at the world around you, they're really good at just going with the flow. So it is, in fact, a very convenient way to live. Just go with the flow. Conviction, however, the other side of the issue, Philippians 4, 11 to 13. Not that I am referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. And then you're just dropping down to verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That is conviction. I can do all things through Christ. So what that means, brethren, is whatever comes your way, whatever happens in your circumstances, in your ecclesia, whatever disagreements you have, and whatever the stress and the pressure is that you feel that you are put under, and maybe it feels like it's too much, this promise is saying, that's one of the all things that was brought to you. And you can do it, not on your own passion, not on your own comfort, not on your own convenience, but you can do it based on the principles, based on godly conscience, and based on conviction. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It's through Christ. So, brethren, we're suggesting that when we have to deal with the troubles and the difficulties and the challenges and the disagreements and the disillusionments and the sadness and the disappointment and even the betrayal that we sometimes feel, walk yourself through the gates and use the mirror test. Which gate am I walking through this time? Which gate am I walking through this time? Which gate am I walking through this time? And that will help us to become out sanctified. And once we come out of the testing ground sanctified, then perhaps we can approach it and claim this promise for what it truly means. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I want to compare, just for a moment, convenience and conviction. And there's a good good example of this, and it's a sobering example, because it has to do with one of the great Christian leaders, the great founders of Christianity, the Apostle Peter. Galatians 2:11 to 16, and again we'll just read portions. But when Cephas, when Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood self-condemned. For unto certain people came from, for until certain people came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But after they came, he drew back and he kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision fashion. So what happened to the Apostle Peter? He got stuck with convenience. He got stuck with comfort. He got stuck with peer pressure. And he faded in his conviction. And it took the Apostle Paul withstanding him, face to the face. Now, Brother David suggested that, you know, the withstanding wasn't this angry yelling and screaming and beating him down, and I tend to agree. But I think it was, when he says, I withstood him to the face, I imagine he got close to him and said, Brother Peter, what are you doing? Look at this. Look at what you're doing. And you see what the apostle says. He says, but when I saw that they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews? You're living a contradiction. What did the apostle do? He spoke truth. He wasn't afraid of the truth. He said what needed to be said. But he didn't beat down the apostle Peter. It wasn't his place. See, he honored the conviction of Peter, and Peter understood afterwards his error. So if the Apostle Peter can be wrong and need correction and accept correction, surely we can be wrong and need correction and accept correction. These are just hopefully some helps for you to be able to understand a process of identifying our own thinking, so that it can cross over that divide from the gate of process that leads us down a road of divisiveness to a process that leads us down a road to decisiveness and caring and ultimately sanctification. Number four, coddling versus caring. When you coddle, you take care of something and you almost overly baby. You know, when coddling, and one of the things I think of is, if you know, you see pictures of these rich and famous young women who have a little dog that they carry around with them, and the dog's dressed up and it's got its little diamonds and its jewelry, and you know, to me that's what coddling is. Okay, that's a little bit over the top, I think. Okay, caring and coddling are two different things. Are we willing to allow the consequences of our actions, or our brother's actions, to come to fruition, or do we coddle them and overprotect? See, there's a difference between protecting and caring and overprotecting. One of the words they use in psychology today is you enable. When you enable somebody, what are you doing? You're giving them a pathway to walk that is not good for them. And you are saying, oh, well, it's okay. By your inaction, oftentimes, we enable others to do wrong things. That actually is coddling, because you're not helping them to grow. Caring. Galatians 6, 1 through 5. Again, we'll just read a portion. You who have received the Spirit should restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. That is what caring is all about. If we care for one another, we are going to look to restore them. And remember, as we talked yesterday in our studies, and we were talking about fellowship and disfellowship, disfellowship is in place for one reason and one reason only. What is it?
Regain your brother.
That's right. Don't ever forget that. if we walk through the wrong side of the gates, we don't even consider that. But if we walk through the right side of the gates, that ends up being our objective. So caring is a very obvious thing. If the Father had coddled Jesus, there would have been no suffering, no experience, and no true compassion on the part of Jesus. The Father would not do that. He loved Jesus too much, and he loved his creation too much. So he allowed Jesus. Well, Hebrews 5, 8 through 14, it says it better than I can. Again, we'll only read portions. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. It says he learned obedience. Jesus had to learn obedience from the standpoint of a human being. He knew obedience. He was the most obedient creation in all of the history of all of the universe. But he had to relearn it from a human perspective. Further down in that verse, in Hebrews chapter 5, Paul shows his care for the church by pressing them to grow up. See, this is caring. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again in the basic elements of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who lives on milk, being still an infant, is unskilled in the word of righteousness. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have faculties that have been trained by practice to distinguish good from evil. The point is that sometimes we get into a point, into a situation where we are leaning toward the coddling of milk and walking away from the caring that the Spirit gives us of growing up. Caring is pressing each other to grow. Not forcing, but giving others, giving our brother, our sister, input so they can grow. I'm going to skip that in the interest of time. Well, no, I don't want to skip it, but I'll just allude to it. Back to 1 Corinthians 5 for a moment. We won't read the text. It's about the brother who had sinned so grievously, and the Corinthians had put him out, and now they needed to bring him back. This is an expression of they were coddling the situation originally. The apostle told them, no, you need to care. You need to really care about your brother. And by putting him out, it was an expression of agape love. Putting him out was an expression of agape love. And it was an expression of filial love. Because it was giving him something to work with to help him to understand how badly he had gone. That's what a brother does for a brother. A brother is going to protect his brother, and a brother is going to help his brother know what he needs to do. So the putting out of that individual was agape love. It was filial love, all wrapped up in a beautiful package because it was for the purpose of drawing him back. Now, they needed help in learning how to, but they did. Number 5, cloudy vision versus clarity of vision. Are we unsure of the objective at hand, or do we have a clear picture of what we are involved in? Again, remember, when we have to deal with our brethren and there's disagreement and there's dissension, always speak the truth, but always honor their conviction. These gates of process are simply a way to help us determine if we are able to truly honor their conviction. You know, for a lot of us, it might be easy to speak what we deem to be the truth. But are we able to clearly honor their conviction? You have a choice. You can enter through the cloudy vision side, or you can enter through the clearer vision side. It's a choice. One is humanly driven, the other is spiritually driven. One leads to human reaction, the other leads to sanctification. Jesus makes the point here that we're naturally cloudy. We are naturally cloudy in our vision. We just are, because we're imperfect human beings. Matthew 7, 1-5, do not judge so that you may not be judged. For with the judgment you make, you will be judged, and the measure you give, it will be given back to you. Why do you see the speck in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, so you will clearly see the speck in your brother's eye. What is he saying? Mirror test. That's what Jesus is saying. Use the mirror test. Take the cloudiness away of yourself first so you can see clearly in addressing your brother. In the interest of time, again, we're just going to give you some verses here. Philippians chapter 3. Verses 3 through 15. Philippians 3, 3 through 15. And in these verses, what we will see, you can read them on your own, Paul is following dramatically an account that reveals common sources of cloudy vision. And then he gets to clear vision. In verses 5 and 6, there's a lot of cloudy vision going on because he's going back and looking at his own human accomplishments. Brother, that's cloudy vision. That doesn't mean anything. Going back and looking at what you've done humanly, that doesn't mean anything. His clarity comes in verse 8. And it's a good example of how the apostle looks back and says, yeah, I could boast about those things, but it's really useless. Here's what's the most important thing. Cloudy vision, what everybody looks at. Clear vision, what spiritually guides us. Another quick example of this one is 1 Kings 18:21. Elijah then came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And so what did the people do? They answered him not a word. So Elijah alone had the clarity of vision and faith to stand before the prophets of Baal and defeat them single-handedly, with the Lord's help, of course. Clarity, brethren, provokes choice. It really does. Clarity provokes choice. The status of our vision is critical to the extreme. The more clarity we attain in our vision, the more profitable our actions will be. The more clarity we attain in our vision, the more profitable, spiritually, sanctifying our actions will be. Number 6, divisive action versus decisive action. You know, they're spelled pretty closely. Not a whole lot of letters difference between being divisive and being decisive. Sometimes we truly feel we're right, and we're actually being divisive. Now see, this is a classic example of when you go get to this gate, you got to go back and check the first one. Remember principle versus passion? Passion versus principle? Because if we're acting on passion first, then chances are we're going to end up being divisive second. So we've got to go back. These are suggested in order so that we can unfold sanctifying thought as we deal with our differences. Quick example, divisive action corrected in a decisive manner. 1 Corinthians 3, 1 through 11. Again, we'll just read a few verses. For while one saith, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, and are ye not carnal? Who then is Paul and who is Apollos? This is divisive actions. Well, I'm lining up behind Paul. Well, I'm lining up behind Apollos. And in another place, I'm going to line up behind Christ. You're both wrong. But the apostle clears it up with decisive thinking. Who then is Paul? Who is Apollos? But ministers by whom ye believed, even as the Lord gave to every man. I have planted, Apollos watered, God gives the increase. So then neither is he that planted anything, neither is he that watereth anything, but God gives the increase. He's taking divisiveness and in a decisive fashion saying, get a grip, brethren, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, get a grip and understand that we are all supposed to be working together. This is one of the most difficult and important gates. To be able to really, truly speak the truth and honor conviction. Divisive action versus decisive action. And I would firmly suggest, as you assess this in your own mind, you go back and review the previous five, because that will help us to understand. We'll refer you to Matthew 18, because our time is running short on that, and we won't... Let me make one more statement on this, and then we'll go on to point number 7. Being imperfect emotional humans, we can easily mistake divisive action for decisive action. We mentioned that. The true barometer of our actions is the source of our convictions. Only you know the source of your convictions, you and the Lord. So it's a very private, quiet revelation that you experience. But the true barometer of your actions is the source of your convictions. And finally, hearsay sources versus honorable sources. Have we truly checked the facts? How do we know that we are basing our thinking on what is honorable and not merely on hearsay? And brethren, this is a big one. This could be an hour right here. Hearsay versus honorable in terms of source. Because hearsay is so easy and it's so convenient and everybody kind of likes it. I'm serious. Unfortunately, we all kind of like it. Because it's convenient. And it's kind of juicy, too. Did you hear? Matthew 26:59-63. Again, a few verses. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for false testimony against Jesus so they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. They thrived on hearsay. They were seeking hearsay. Make something up. Come and tell us. Because that's the only way they could convict Jesus. That's hearsay, brethren. Hearsay leads to dishonesty and death. That's a simple equation for you. In Philippians 4:8 is the other side. Finally, beloved, whatever is true, honorable, just, pure, pleasing, commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's any virtue, think about these things. I don't see hearsay in there. I don't see half-baked ideas in there. I don't see hearing something from somebody who said something about somebody who said something about somebody who said something in there. That's not honorable. See, if we're going to speak truth, that's great. And I'm sure it's easy to focus on that. But do we honor conviction by really testing the source? And sometimes, brethren, you know what? That can be embarrassing. It can be. And it can create a little bit of extra stress and tension. Because you hear something that you maybe shouldn't be listening to. How many times do we have the courage to say, excuse me, you know what, I really don't think it's appropriate for me to be listening to this. How many times do we say that? How many times should we say that? We get sucked in by the feeling of the moment. Well, I don't want to offend anybody. Well, you are. You know who you're offending? The person being spoken about. And you know what you're becoming potentially guilty of? Slander. And you know what Jesus says about slander? Look at Matthew 5. He talks about slander in the context of Gehenna. So the next time hearsay comes along, think about it in terms of speaking the truth and honoring the conviction of those who you might be hearing that juicy stuff about and say, wait a minute. If I'm going to truly honor their conviction, then I have no business hearing hearsay. I have no business hearing hearsay. Brethren, the bottom line here is our Christian liberty. You have the liberty to choose which side of each gate you will enter. The Lord gives you that ability. He, in testing us for faithfulness, is going to say to us, I am planting you in an environment where there is trial, where there's difficulty, where there's dissension, where there's discouragement, where there's trouble. I will provide you with everything you need so that you have principle and godly conscience and conviction and caring and clarity of vision and decisive action and honorable sources. I will make those available to you every time in every circumstance. You, on the other hand, could choose to feel the passion and the emotion, to be comfortable, to do the things that are convenient, to coddle, to have cloudy vision, to be divisive, and to work on hearsay. It's our choice. Brethren, we live at very difficult times. Let us be very, very, very sober and careful about our dealings one with another. Because they are difficult. These are the things that can create faithfulness and sanctification in us and our brother. Or these are the things that could create destruction. What if you're wrong? What if you're wrong? By the Lord's grace, perhaps now we have some tools to help us answer that question and then have the courage to act with a godly conscience toward the end of sanctification and faithfulness for all. May the Lord add his blessing.